Welcome to Redefining the Good Life, the podcast that calls BS on the rat race of modern life and helps you finally have the courage to go after your dreams. I'm your host, Ayşen Karaduman, aka The Omnivorist. I'm a life coach and functional nutritional therapy practitioner. Using a blend of mindset tools and ancestral nutrition, as well as understanding just what it means to be human today, I'm here to help you change the trajectory of your life. Another future is possible, my friend. Welcome on board. Hello, lovely people. I hope you've been having a wonderful week. I have a real special treat for you today. I am presenting my interview with none other than Peter Michael Bauer, who is really well known for his work in rewilding. In this conversation, we go lots of places. We tackle some really big, juicy questions, including what to do when faced with the end of civilization. But it's really not as bleak as you might think. You really, really don't want to miss this one. Peter Michael Bauer is an anthropologist, experimental archaeologist, and historian. Peter's work focuses on the social and environmental impacts of the Neolithic Revolution and how understanding those impacts can provide us with solutions to the sixth mass extinction. Since the early 2000s, he's been an integral catalyst in the human rewilding movement. Rewilding is a principle or a lens that helps us see and move through the world in terms of regeneration and reciprocity. It is not the one right way, it is rather a million ways to live in the flow of natural cycles. It recognizes that humans are not above those flows, and that it is actually more beneficial to our ecosystems when we acknowledge and become part of them. This movement works to create resilience through the return to place-based regenerative subsistence strategies inspired by those that exist outside of and those that existed prior to the formation of agrarian states. Peter created the first international online rewilding forum, which is now archived at discuss.rewild.com. He wrote a book on rewilding called Rewild or Die, which I would highly recommend. He created the annual North American Rewilding Conference and founded the organization Rewild Portland, where he also teaches online classes. And again, I would highly recommend those. And of course, you can find all of his information in the show notes. So without further ado, let's get to it. All right. Well, Peter, welcome. I am so excited to have you on my podcast. This is my first ever interview. Very special for me.
Oh, awesome. Glad to be here.
I discovered you, it was more than a year ago. It was on the Uncivilized podcast, which, you know, that interview completely blew my mind. So everybody go check that out. Unfortunately, that podcast is no longer, but one of the last episodes is with Peter and it's really, really good. And then I started following you. I read your book, Rewild or Die. And I took also Rewilding 101 online, which was one of the, let's say, silver linings of the whole pandemic. More things became available online and worldwide.
Nice. So, yeah, totally.
Yeah. And it was really like, it just blew my mind. It was like, I still think about that course. And, you know, again, when you do it again next, people, you need to take it. It's just so like, it was so many things, right? It was depressing. It was infuriating. It was like, it was hopeless and then hopeful and inspiring and exhilarating. I just think it's really required knowledge to be in our world today. We can talk a little bit about like maybe those concepts around civilization and what rewilding means. And also, you and I completed a six months of coaching together, which was really awesome for me. And hopefully it was for you too. And then maybe we can talk about that stuff also, like in terms of how it relates to modern mental health, basically. So maybe what we can start with is a little bit on your origin story, which, you read a certain book and when you were like 16, I think, in high school.
Yeah. Yeah, I read Ishmael by Daniel Quinn, and I dropped out of high school a day late. So first of all, you need to know, like, I hadn't read a book from start to finish in years, right? Like, I mean, we were supposed to do that for school and stuff. I was the laziest student. I would watch the movies. It's not that I didn't like reading, but I've had challenges focusing on things in particular that I'm not interested in.
Very natural response.
You know, yeah. I think, you know, it'd be diagnosed as somewhere between depression and ADHD and the DSM or something like that. But, you know, being able to read a book that I was just interested in on my own and had all of these answers that I had been asking, you know, at that point in my life, I was already sort of starting to ask a lot of questions. I think one of which that actually inspired me to get this book was the end of Terminator 2. Arnold Schwarzenegger says, "It's in your nature to destroy yourselves" in regard to humanity. And I remember watching that movie and being like, I don't believe that. Like, that is something that is like inherent in our society today. We believe that it's our nature to destroy ourselves. I don't believe that. Like, where does that idea come from? I do not have an innate desire to destroy the world around me. I want to live in harmony. Therefore, it can't be, you know, I can't just be unique on my own. And so I had this philosophical conversation with a friend of mine, and she was like, wow, well, all of the things you're asking are like kind of summed up in this book, Ishmael by Daniel Quinn. You should read it. And so, of course, I read it. And 2 days later, I had dropped out of high school, ran away from home, and was like saving up money to go to a wilderness survival school so that I could learn to, you know, survive the apocalypse or just the collapse of civilization or whatever. I, you know, this is a 16-year-old without a lot of context in regard to how all of those things happen. But, you know, feeling the urgency that is present in that book before a lot of other people felt that urgency. This is in the mid-90s.
And so for those who aren't familiar with the book, like, I know it's hard to sum up in just a few words, but what would you say?
Yeah, I think, you know, what Ishmael does is it's a Socratic dialogue, a fictional Socratic dialogue about nonfiction. But what it does is it goes through and analyzes the mythology of civilization and makes the invisible visible. So the things that we don't consider as mythology, it presents to us as like, actually, here's the things that you believe, and here's why you believe them, and here's why they're wrong, essentially. Or here's like a more accurate representation of reality, right? You know, I think one of the basis myths of civilization is that this is the way that we're living is the one right way for humanity. And that way is an agricultural subsistence method. And, you know, when you look around at, you know, a great example of this in the contemporary era is the use of the term Anthropocene extinction. So Anthropocene is, you know, human made extinction, basically, but it wasn't a human made extinction. Humanity didn't create this extinction, right? The Bushmen are living relatively similarly to how they could have been 10,000 or more years ago, or 40,000 years ago. So the Bushmen as a society and as a representation of humanity didn't create the sixth extinction, and therefore humanity did not create it. But this conflation of humanity with civilization in particular, which is one culture, one expression of humanity, is one of the central myths of civilization, that we did this, and we being humanity rather than this particular culture. And if it's not humanity that brought us to the brink, but a culture, then we have the ability to change our culture and be at once more like in a more harmonious state with or an energetic balance calorically with our environments, instead of consuming more than we need to survive. And so that's kind of the central theme of that book, I think, is that idea of, you know, he divides cultures into what he calls takers and leavers. Takers meaning they've taken their lives into their own hands, which, you know, I disagree with a lot of his framework. I think it was oversimplified and not nuanced enough, but it serves a purpose to kind of get the gist, you know. And I think the relative gist of what he's saying is still pretty accurate. I've moved on a lot since his writing, but I think that his way of seeing the world actually is sort of my fundamental thought process now. Like, I feel like his foundation gave me a lens with which to look sort of across the board at everything.
But, you know, in the years that that book came out, I think it's going to go on 30 years soon. A lot of people have still not gotten the memo, right? Like, I still think that book is like a total, almost like a slap in the face, like the way he distills it. So, I mean, it's so clearly, of course, you said oversimplification, but it gets the job done. And then you can go on and, you know, add nuance to it. But basically the idea that we today, in our, we are a very specific culture. We can't speak for all of humanity. And I mean, we have so many things going against us, right? Number one being our arrogance around what our civilization means, all of its accomplishments. We're just so in love with our own accomplishments to the point of, you know, we think of the prehistoric ages as this really dark thing and where life was like nasty, brutish, and short. But no, that's just a very specific way of seeing the world.
Totally.
And it wasn't that way.
Yeah.
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 And not only that, what I like about this is, like, the way he puts it is, it's not optional, actually. Whether or not we're aware of it, like, we are subject to the laws of nature.
Totally.
Exactly. It's not like an if or but a when kind of proposition.
So, I mean, and I think that was sort of the catalyst for me in terms of, you know, wanting to understand how to live outside of the industrial civilizational complex. You know, I mean, I grew up urban Portland kid, no connection to my food, no connection to my water, living in a densely populated area, no understanding of how to live, how to actually, like, sustain a life. And so I think, you know, in reading his books, there was this sense of urgency of, like, oh, this shit's going to collapse, right? Like, we're still subjected to the laws of nature, even though our culture ignores them. And so, you know, at that point, it catalyzed me to learn at the time what I thought of as survival skills, which now I definitely differentiate between survival skills and ancestral skills. But to just kind of understand a more minimalist type of technology that you can regenerative, meaning grown from the environment in which you live, all of the things that you need readily available within a, you know, an arm's reach, or to be able to craft the things that you need with your hands. So experience in crafting, understanding, you know, how to make baskets or, you know, bows and arrows or things that you need to procure food, fishing line, all that stuff from natural materials. Not to say that you have to rely on those, but at some point, you know, there is definitely a transition, a diminishing returns of civilization where all of the things that are industrially produced now will cease to be. And so we will still have a lot of those things for hundreds of years.
For better or for worse,
Right. And plastics break down eventually, but we'll have 5-gallon buckets for 50 years and, you know, after they stop being produced or whatever. It's not so much about anymore. For me, I recognize that the urgency, it's still urgent and it gets more urgent every day. But that I feel like I have a pretty good understanding that no matter what happens, it's going to relatively be completely random. Like, it doesn't really matter how much preparation you think you're doing for whatever collapse you think is coming. The survival rates of a transitioning civilization are completely randomized to the point where it's so complex you have no idea what to expect. And so that the best position to be in is one of the most adaptability that one can have possible.
And I guess that's the biggest question, right? Like, how can we be resilient as modern humans?
Right. I mean, and I mean, to me, what that means is understanding at core what the needs of a human are and how to get them on a base level. So identifying, you know, one of the things I've been fascinated with recently is I've done experimentations with diets and stuff for a really long time, paleo diet, stuff like that for 20 years now. But I never really understood the energy balance. It was never something of calories versus energy expenditure. It was not something that I ever really delved into. And then I was watching that show Alone, which is a survival, you know, it's billed as a survival skills show. It's not. I just want to point that out again. People don't understand what a survival context is. Alone is not a survival show. Alone is a minimalist wilderness living experience. It's not a survival show.
So, sorry, can you just distinguish for us? And what you mentioned earlier is survival skills versus ancestral skills. Is it a semantic thing for you, or do they look different, or is it where it's coming from?
No, it's context. And this is important because this goes along too with, like, you know, when we talk about prehistoric people or hunter-gatherers, even contemporary, we talk about them surviving. What do they need? What does a human need to survive, right? Not like, what does a human body need to continue living at like a base level, a baseline level of like what human comfort looks like, right? So when we think about hunter-gatherers and we talk about them in survival, you know, what do they need to survive? And they spent millions of years surviving in the wilderness. It's like, no, survival is a very specific context. Survival means that you are in an unfamiliar area and you've been removed from your culture and your cultural routines of a particular place and knowledge base. So you are, a survival context would be you're an urban person. You know the city you live in, right? You know your neighborhood. And if you were to, if you were walking in your neighborhood and you tripped and fell and broke your leg or something, like, you'd know who to call. You'd have access to these different, you know, cultural resources. You're not in a survival context. Maybe if you're bleeding to death, but then we have EMS here or something, right? Whereas nowadays, like, if a real sort of survival context would be like your plane crashes, your boat shipwrecks on an island, you're in an unfamiliar place, you're removed entirely from your cultural practices, you have no tools, you have no people that are established, right? But hunter-gatherers had and still have in some places, you know, seasonal routines. They know their environments. They know where the food is. They don't have to go and find it.
Right. It's not like they're constantly moving. It's like they have their, you know,
exactly. They're, even though they're nomadic, it doesn't mean that they don't know where they're going, that they're wandering. Nomadic people go to very specific sites and they're generally like seasonal garden, seasonal availability of food. And they know where those places are, right? Like, so in the same way that, like, say you're in a, we think of the bow drill as like a survival skill, being able to start a fire by rubbing sticks together. That's a survival skill. But in a hunter-gatherer society, you know where the trees are to make those tools. You have the experience growing up making them. If you need a fire, you can just go and make it. In this, it might take a little bit more energetic effort in the way that, you know, it's less effort for us to open a drawer and pull out a lighter in our house. But those techniques and those tools would just be lying around ancestral, you know, hunter-gatherer societies or ancestral or pre-industrial or non-industrial people. They just had the things that they needed readily available. A survival context is when you don't have the things for your basic needs readily available. You're in an unfamiliar environment. You don't know where the water is. You don't have a structure already built to sleep in. You have to do this shit on the fly. That is survival. So, you know, hunter-gatherers don't live in a constant state of survival. They have seasonal routines. They have technology. They have all of those things. So that's not to say that they can't also be in a survival situation, right? Like, right. But that they weren't living in one. And that living, when you're in a survival situation, there are two ways to get out of it. One is to walk back to your culture, an environment that is familiar, right? So walking out of the wilderness. Or two is to be rescued by people from your culture. Those are how you get out of a survival context, getting back to your culture and environment or being rescued by your culture, right? So that's because survival is essentially a constant emergency. Ancestral living is not a constant emergency. You have routines in place. You know where the things are. An emergency can occur just like in any society. An earthquake is going to change things, you know? But it's not the same thing. So when I think about these shows, and this is really important because you watch these television shows and they say that they're survival shows. So you see these things and you think, oh, these are survival skills. If I get into a survival situation, this is what I should do. And people die because they don't understand that what their main objective should be is to get rescued or to walk out if they can't, if they don't think they're going to get rescued, right? And so people die because they follow what these survival shows, quote unquote survival shows, tell them to do. But those are not how to be rescued when you're in a survival situation.
Right. Those are TV shows. I mean, they're by definition not in a survival situation. Yeah.
And so like, you know, for alone, for example, is not a survival context. They're intentionally putting themselves into the wilderness, first of all. So it's not a survival context. They have a button they can press to be rescued. So it's a minimalist wilderness living experience. And I say minimalist because they take gear with them. They're not using ancestral skills per se. I mean, my friend Wonia took a lot of her ancestral skill stuff and did a lot of that stuff on the show. She loves doing that. It applies to a wilderness context like that. Oftentimes why there's a conflation between survival skills and ancestral skills is because depending on the context, it could be this a tool that is used in either one of those contexts is sort of meets in the middle. An example is bow drill. If you grow up in a hunter-gatherer culture, non-industrial culture, you have bow drills lying around or friction fire methods lying around. You don't need to make them in an emergency situation. They're already there. However, if you're in an emergency situation, then you could potentially make one from scratch. And that's what makes the bow drill both an ancestral skill and a survival skill, is the ability to make a bow drill from scratch, from natural material around you. Now, you might not know what the best material is if you're in a survival situation where you're out of your environmental context, but you can experiment at the very least and try to get something somewhere in the line, right?
Yeah. Something you said earlier that I wanted to kind of go back to a little bit is you said, we first even like, I think it was in response to how to be resilient in as modern humans now that we're so deep into this situation, to understand first what the needs of a human are. And I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding of what those needs truly are.
Oh, totally.
And what the needs that our civilization is attending to versus what our true needs are. They're not always in alignment.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, and that's exactly why I was interested in, or one of the parts of Alone that intrigued me. And I love the shows, don't get me wrong. I'm not really interested in putting myself out in the wilderness in a minimalist context the way that the show Alone does. But what I am interested in is the adaptability that is required to survive through decentralization of civilization, which is essentially what the elite call collapse, but for everyone else looks like a decentralization.
What is that distinction? Tell me more about that. What do you mean the elite call that collapse and the rest of us don't?
We think about
maybe we are the elite. I don't know what you mean.
Yeah, I mean, everybody has a different position on the hierarchy. In some sense, just being an American makes me elite globally, right? But not in a regional sense, not at all. But essentially collapse means, we think about it as the most horrible thing. Oh no, our society is going to collapse and be destroyed. And but the reality is that, look, there's a great book called Questioning Collapse, first of all, that I highly recommend people read. It goes through every single chapter of Jared Diamond's collapse and reframes it by the actual archaeologists and anthropologists who work in the locations that Jared Diamond cited for his book Collapse. The subtitle is How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed. And they go through and basically deconstruct the idea that societies have a choice in that matter of falling or not. And then also what is succeeding and what is failure and how is that graphed? How do you decide what is a failure of a society versus success? And when we think about that, oftentimes what we realize is that there's a hierarchy in place. And the hierarchy is itself sustained through particular systems of complexity. And when they get too complex, they basically collapse under their own weight. And when we talk about complexity, what we're talking about is like social stratification. So slavery, for example, and an elite class. And when those get so stratified, they collapse, which means that those in power lose their power. And those who were enslaved are free. Because the social order is what collapsed. And so what happens is those powers, what they've been doing is centralizing people in core populations, like consolidating them in specific locations that we call cities. And so that's where they're able to maintain the labor force in a large part, before cities, agricultural zones. Now what happens in a collapse is that it decentralizes. So you have basically what was, a consolidation of power is now a decentralized and disbanding, and it's a voluntary thing. People will walk away because there's no one there holding a gun to their head, forcing them to pay taxes or till a soil or whatever.
Yeah, but here's what I want to say to that. I feel like we're at a different place today. I feel like with the, we're so far into this civilization, it's like there is no single person who holds the keys to, you know, quote unquote survivor. Or there never was. But I mean, we don't have the skills. Like, we don't even have to be very privileged. I mean, I do consider you and I to be very privileged. But even if, like, we speak of people who are really not privileged at all in today's world, they don't have, like, how we don't know how to, you know, grow our own food. We don't know how to take care of ourselves.
Absolutely.
Because everything's so cheap, right? You buy the reason, everything.
Well, right. So there's a thing here too, based on need, right? And we don't need to grow our own food. The solution, all of the solutions to all of the problems in the world, climate change, everything, they already exist. The reason that they haven't been implemented is because that there is a power structure in place that is preventing them from happening. When the collapse happens, that power structure that is preventing people from moving forward goes away. Mm. That's not to say that it'll be all peace and love. But, you know, again, if you look at societies that have quote unquote collapsed in the past, it's a decentralization that moves away from the complexity back to more simplistic ways of living that are more resilient. So the complexity is not resilient. Resilience is decentralization. So we're all waiting on those in power to make these bigger decisions for us. They're never going to, because their power, they have power because of the system that exists today. So it won't be until they collapse that these solutions start happening en masse all over, because people are actually not only forced to do it out of necessity, but they are actually now given the choice to do it, because there isn't a power structure that is intentionally maintaining an imbalance of power.
So in the absence of centralized power, you're saying people will be able to reorganize in more, like, in more local ways.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, think about this. In World War II, and this is a minor example that is still even within the state's framework. In World War II, the state diverted so much agriculture and growing operations to the war effort that people had to start victory gardens. And within like 2 years or less, people were growing like 50% of the food that they would have been buying at the grocery store in their backyards and in their neighborhoods and things, right? Resilience, when it is necessary, is a very easy thing. I mean, it's not hard to grow food. You put a seed in the ground. Yes, there's a lot of nuance and challenges that can arise with that. But like people like us who don't have a lot of those skills, they're just waiting for us to pick up.
I guess it's a question also of like, are we going to continue to have electricity? Are we going to continue to have clean
Absolutely.
Water
and all, the
all those things that come up, right? Like, I guess it depends on different, as you say, it's not going to be one big, one fell swoop. It's going to be-
Resilience is sticky. So think about the pandemic and how like overnight people were like cutting up extra fabric they had, cutting up old clothes, like people were making masks. All these different people were experimenting with different kinds of masks. And then the ones that were more effective were like the ones that, oh no, this one's great. Oh, this is more comfortable. You know, like just, and boom, within like a month, the world, you know, it within the world, you know, had adjusted to the need, right? That and so resilience and innovation like that, when they are necessary and there's a direct pull to do it, happen very rapidly. And that happens. You see that even Rebecca Solnit's book, you know, my two favorite books to quote or to cite rather are the one I already mentioned, Questioning Collapse, because that's an overall larger picture of larger scale collapses of societies throughout history. But Rebecca Solnit's is a great example of just plain old crises that happen within communities. So it's more of like a microcosm of collapse, right? And so her book, Paradise Built in Hell, I think the subtitle is like The Power of Communities in Disaster or something like that, just goes to show that, again, people will band together to create and get their needs met, at least in short term, in the short term like that, you know? And it's really the state that tries to maintain its monopoly on violence and power as the systems are crumbling around it that are responsible for the majority of atrocities that happen during those times.
And yet one of the things that, again, goes back to the way we our own civilization wants us to think we have a flawed nature. Like, as you know, as humans, we are always going to be greedy and, you know, competitive and kind of want to kill everything around us and, you know, be always stronger. And yet what you're saying here, and I have to read that Rebecca Solnit book, it's been on my list forever, about just actually that isn't really who we are, and who we truly are comes out in these very spectacular moments of catastrophe.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's both. I think there are situations that I think there are both environments that create greedy behaviors. I mean, civilization is a great example. And there are environments that
it's the story, right? It's the story we tell about behaviors. Ourselves that we're totally. Enacting
absolutely.
All the time.
And yes, that's a part of it, but also just like mechanically, you know, in psychologically, like say, you know, in prisons, right? They realize if prisoners have like pink jumpsuits, the violence rate decreases statistically. Why? Because it's some weird psychological thing we don't fully know. But when prisoners have pink jumpsuits on, they don't fight as much. So, you know, environmental psychology plays a huge role on our behaviors. And so, you know, so that's a factor. You know, another factor is, yeah, the stories that we're telling each other. And then another factor too is that there are people who are just more prone to violence through genetics, you know. Sociopathy is a thing, right?
But that will never be, so I think, a majority, right? It's yes, when you have a psychopathic culture that, you know, kind of does that. And also environment, I mean, the environment we create, you know, this is actually going to a coaching concept, the model, right? You know, the environment is something that gets created as a result of our thinking in the first place. And our thinking, if we're telling a certain story, then that, like in our modern life, that's the environment we're creating. And of course, we're seeing that with food, with lifestyle, with community, with closeness or lack thereof, all of that stuff. And actually with that, I want to segue into, you know, when I mentioned human needs earlier, what I also was wanted to talk about is this idea of, again, our nature and what we need as humans, like psychically, emotionally, mentally, that we have a really hard time getting in today's world, in the modern world, just how isolated we live from each other to begin with, and those stories we tell. And yeah, I wanted to kind of get into that a little bit. And the other thing, this is kind of related, I think, is the idea that I found out as I was getting into this stuff is like the concept of scarcity, how that is like a big one that our like civilization runs on. And we think, oh my God, these people like lived hand to mouth for millions of years. And thankfully we figured out agriculture and all this amazing stuff. But no, actually scarcity came along with agriculture.
Absolutely.
It was not like we were not living hand to mouth or desperate.
Yeah,
before.
I think, you know, it's interesting. Like there's this thing about hunter gatherers being hungry all the time, right? And it's part myth and it's part true in the sense of they don't have food storage. So when they're hungry, they go get it, right? Like their food storage is stored in the environment. And they can be hungry a lot of the time, but it's not starvation hunger. And I think, and it's also not blood sugar hunger. And it's also interesting because the higher protein content in your diet, the less likely you are to have starvation, physiological starvation responses. So, you know, when we're talking about hunter gatherers, the majority of their calories, even though they're definitely eating plants, the majority of the calories come from protein and fat from an animal, right? So even if they were hungry, they weren't like the quality of their hunger is different than the quality of agriculturalist hunger.
Yeah. It's that difference between being sugar adapted versus fat adapted, right? When your metabolism is, you know, running on fat more, it's just going to be, or fat and protein more, it's just going to be none of that, like, I'm going to kill some, not the hanger, right? The hanger, which is like a totally modern thing.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. But in terms of all of our other needs, like there's just so many, it's hard to even know where to start. And it's hard to even know, you know, which ones to take priority on, you know, because they're all so intertwined. I think lately I'm creating a mental web in my mind of the central needs of the body and mind and spirit, and all those things are so deeply connected. You can't really separate them. You know, we need an adequate amount of sleep, not just to restore the body, but to restore our brain and our emotions. You know, if you don't get enough sleep, the body ends up craving more calories. So you end up eating more. If you don't get enough sleep, you don't want to exercise. But in order to sleep well, you need to exercise. So it becomes this negative feedback loop, right? Where if you're not exercising, you're not sleeping well. If you're not sleeping well, you're not exercising. And that's that feedback loop is connected to everything else within the body and mind. It's not just those two things alone, right? Like, so it's just one of those things where it's like, how do you get the ball rolling, right? And you kind of have to just pick whatever the thing is that you're most interested in and do it, you know? For me, you know, again, movement in general is something that I've been focusing on as a way of starting out in terms of spiraling or creating a negative feedback loop that is the opposite, where I'm exercising well so that I'm sleeping well and then I want to exercise well the next day or whatever, you know, and the same thing with diet and what I'm eating, how often I'm eating, what I'm eating, you know, how I'm breathing, all of the different kinds of exercise that I could be doing. And then, you know, just like the mindfulness and awareness and meditation and all of those things. And it's just fascinating kind of thinking about how to integrate these things into a life that has turned us into domesticated animals where we don't, where mobility is trained. We're fed a particular, like an animal feed, like feedlot cattle, to keep us generating power for those in power.
Yeah, depressing, but it's pretty much it. You know, we're captive humans, right? We're living in captivity.
So actually, there's this interesting balance that comes into play there of like not just wanting to. You know, I think initially when I was a teenager, I read Ishmael. That catalyzed me almost solely on fear, right? Like fear of the collapse. Fear of this decentralization and the need to learn how to be adaptable because I wanted to survive the collapse. These days, I'm not interested so much in surviving a collapse. I think in part because I don't worry, like after reading so much about societies during collapse, I don't worry too much about that anymore because I trust in the process. And so what my focus on now is not being adaptable for the collapse of civilization, but rather focusing on community, personal and communal health, and setting a stage for deepening the connections that I know become possible during decentralization. So, you know, what needs do we have and how do we fulfill those and make sure that they're being fulfilled as society decentralizes? And so in terms of adaptability, for me, it's about becoming as healthy as possible as an individual and then figuring out how to leverage that, in a sense, privilege, even though
which has become or luxury, right? Even, even though it's our being.
Yeah, right. Even though it's a birthright. Yeah, exactly. Even though it's considered maybe even a luxury here, how do I leverage that so that other people can experience that too? And in particular, as society transitions into a, you know, decentralized one.
You're making me very happy for my choice of work.
There is a challenge though. I think that my one caveat with kind of like the intense focus on health is that it ends up kind of being stuck there instead of, from a systemic point of view, my objective isn't to become healthy just for
right.
shits.
It's not
and
like the biohacking stuff, right? Good. Like health is a communal affair, actually.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And if we want to actually do preventative medicine and change it on a systemic level, that requires a lot more than me just being concerned about getting six-pack abs or something. Right. And so the majority of like the life hack stuff is all geared toward more aesthetics, I think, and individual, in a sense, it's leveraging sort of the selfishness and greed that is already inherent
right.
in our
it's
society.
Not exactly like an anti-civilizational, like radical
exactly.
act at all, right? It's
exactly.
just like, it's just, let's just consume differently, but not get out of, like, not opt out of the system.
Exactly. Yes. So for me, there's this trade-off where I have to be, if and when I'm teaching stuff around health, it's very much geared toward systemic stuff, right? Like there's definitely band-aids. We need first aid. You know, I think of something like barefoot shoes as a first aid, right? But it's not a systemic change. And if you get stuck in the capitalist first aid phase, you know, because that's really what first aid is, the things that you can buy to help you just right now, whereas systemic requires dismantling the whole system. And so because we live in a capitalist society that plays off of the illnesses that it gives us, now they have all of these great things that we can get and then forget that we are still ill, right? And forget that the system itself is what's causing them. So we can buy barefoot shoes. We can buy supplemental food, you know, or pills, or, you know, the things that we need instead of getting it from a diet that is like something that we've foraged and that it's not toxic and all those things, right? Like we can. And so for me, there's like this line of recognizing, yeah, it's all about focusing on an individual's health, but not really, because the individual health is related to the community and the community is related to the larger cultural systems in place. And so what is the systemic connection? You know, what is the first aid that we're working on right now so we can feel good enough to work on the systemic problems, right? Whereas most, you know, and I think about this with climate change. Climate change is a great example. You know, Al Gore at the very end of his movie, An Inconvenient Truth, which outlines the horror of climate change from the perspective of what it was 20 years ago, you know, his solution was buy light bulbs, which is one of the most empty, ridiculous, I mean, just laughable, just completely laughable. Like, it's not a solution.
We all did.
It's nothing. Yeah, we did. We bought light bulbs and it didn't fucking matter because the system didn't change. What he did was create a capitalist fake solution that stole the conversation about fundamental change and turned it into a consumer solution, which didn't actually prove any results. So, you know, again, there's this level of like, how do you, but, and the light bulbs were fine. Who cares, right? Yeah, sure. Consume less. It's more energy efficient, yada, yada. But it didn't fucking do anything. So I want to always have that present when we're talking about rewilding in particular, because it's a systemic.
Yeah, maybe actually go ahead and explicitly explain to us your definition of rewilding, which I know has evolved over the years.
I can't remember what I'm using right now, but it changes day to day, hour to hour. My definition is getting more and more scientifically specific. And almost more specific to like almost a mechanistic worldview, to be honest, which I don't particularly subscribe to. However,
you're shocking me, Peter.
there's a thermodynamics of energy flow and energy flow systems, and the objective of a species, whether plant or animal, is to find a balance within the thermodynamic flow of an ecosystem and its energetics, meaning it's not consuming more than it is giving back in some way or another. Or if it is, it's helping maintain other systems. So for example, you know, classic example, deer populations and wolf populations. Wolves are an apex predator. Without wolves, the deer overpopulate, they overbrowse, and entire landscapes are damaged. So there's this constant interplay of species and in terms of energy fluctuation that is seeking a sort of harmonious flow. It's not ever static. It's in constant change. And if you think about each species as having its own will, all of these species are essentially in congress with one another, each one an expression of a will, but a will of wills. So the ecosystem itself has a collective of wills. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the etymology of the word wild is actually like forest or something, right? But when we think about its antonym, domestication, I don't think that the antonym of wild is domestication. But when we think of the word domestication, it's not a binary between wild and domesticated. Domesticated means to break the will of an animal so that you can control it. So if we think of wild as willed, a willed animal, it's not actually the etymology, but it is the actual meaning, right? So wild comes from wald, which is a forest, but a forest, you know, a forest is in constant growth. It's resisting, you know, being tamed, right? So ecosystems are in constant flux. So if you think of wildness as willedness, of maintaining that constant flux of action interaction, domestication is a weird thing of imposing a will over all wills. So the will of a wolf to eat, you know, an animal when it's hungry, those are going to end up, you know, maintaining systems at large.
They, of course, we will see themselves. It as like the evil wolf goes and eats the poor little animals, and we tell entire tales around that. Whereas, no, that's sure, just
yeah,
us the predator, again through our lens.
Yeah, right?
No, yeah, they're yeah. no yeah. like the wolves aren't trying to subjugate all the deer populations and kill everything that gets in the way.
Yes.
Yeah.
The wolf eats when it's hungry, and so there are all of these systems in place, checks and balances that keep ecosystems in a relatively homeostatic, you know, homeostasis type of flow. Those can get disrupted by all kinds of things, larger scale disturbance, volcanic eruptions, weather mm-hmm. events, you know, I mean, it's not, but they always try to find or, you know, and it's not necessarily conscious. It's just thermodynamics are looking for these homeostatic states, and they eventually prop up and they last for a while. Something happens, they transform into something else, find another level of homeostasis and stay there for a while.
And the more diversity there is, the more likelihood that somehow there will be resilience yes. of that ecosystem.
Yes.
And, you know, some
because
will go, but some
web.
Will stay. And,
exactly.
Right. Which again, in the current state of affairs where we are destroying
yes.
planetary diversity, we're making ourselves more and more vulnerable.
So the thing about domestication is that it is essentially a break from homeostasis. It is like a natural disaster because there are biological laws in terms of evolution that find this homeostasis. So homeostasis isn't designed even to just be in a constant state. It's designed to be in flux, right? It's when the fluctuations get very large that we end up having things like extinction events. Domestication, and this is where we're getting back into, like, circling back to Daniel Quinn. He had this thing that he called the law of limited competition. And he presented it as a law of ecology that humans hadn't yet understood, or that maybe we did at one point, and then...
The takers, anyway. Yeah.
Yes. So the law of limited competition states that any plant or animal can compete to the best of its abilities, but cannot seek out and destroy or wage war against its competitors. Meaning a pack of wolves, isn't going to go hunt down and kill all of the grizzly bears because they both share the same food sources, right? Like, that's absurd. They would just never do that for a lot of reasons. And that's not to say that those things don't ever happen.
But as a general rule, they don't.
That law can be broken. But what happens when it does is
consequences.
It leads to these massive disturbances, right? Yeah, the homeostasis is broken. And so domestication is essentially that. Domestication is, so instead of a conscious commensal relationship, domestication is like a commensal parasitic one. And when people say that, there's no real difference between wildness and domestication, to me, that's like saying there's no difference between sex and rape. One is consensual and potentially benefits both people. The other is imposed on someone else violently. That's not a binary, right? There's just making love and then there's forcing somebody. That's not a binary between those mm-hmm. things.
So your notion of rewilding is, unlike the way some environmentalists use it, it's not just about ecology. We're talking about ecology, yes, but also human beings.
Absolutely, yeah.
Like the domestication of the world and the domestication of ourselves, yeah. actually.
I mean, conservation biologists are not talking about domestication. What they're talking, and their form of wildness doesn't recognize that humans live wild.
Humans actually have an impact, had an impact
exactly,
on the environment.
Exactly, and not necessarily positive or negative, but a homeostasis, right?
Yeah.
They weren't acting as a massive force of disturbance that ruins the homeostasis of ecosystems. Yeah. That's not to say that we never did that in the past in particular places, in particular times, But overall, there's never been a culture at the scale of civilization that has done this through the process specifically of domestication. So when we talk about rewilding, what we're talking about is finding a relationship of reciprocity with our environments once again, the way humans lived for 3 million years or more, depending on how you define human. You know, not necessarily talk about it in terms of benefit or, you know, good or bad, but rather just homeostasis, where our level of disturbance is balanced by our level of regeneration.
Right. That's such a great way to put it. Our level of disturbance is balanced by our level of regeneration. That's certainly not where we are today.
Nope.
Yeah. It's like just our way or the highway.
And we will be.
Yeah.
Right?
We'll be forced, eventually.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So how can we take this from, I think my own struggle is that I get these ideas. I get super even very into these ideas and excited about these ideas. But how can I bring that from being an intellectual understanding to something more embodied, something more somatic? What might that look like for any individual? In many different contexts, of course, but
you can I mean, that's what I think that is sort of the individual challenge that I would like charge people with. Once you understand the nature of rewilding, is how to make it manifest in your particular context. And I think it's too, you know, Daniel Quinn never gave, he was very much about not giving prescriptions, to the point where, you know, he was like, I'm like the Surgeon General. The Surgeon General said smoking causes cancer. The Surgeon General didn't say stop smoking, right? And he's like, what I'm saying is breaking the law of limited competition is destroying the world.
I guess, you know, this again goes into this coaching model, right? Like, which is what I always talk about. We have circumstances. We have thoughts about our circumstances. Our thoughts create our feelings. Our feelings drive our actions, and our actions create our results. So it's almost like he's saying, you know, if you believe this thing that I'm telling you, then it's up to you. How are you going to feel?
Exactly.
And what are you going to want to do with that feeling? It's up to us, to each of us, to kind of figure that out,
exactly.
I guess.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that's why it's really hard. People, you know, over the years, 20 years now, I've had producers from reality TV shows and documentary filmmakers and stuff. And they always kind of want to film me, you know, like explaining how to rewild or whatever. And I'm just like, there's no, what are you talking about? How do you rewild? Like, that's not a question I could answer, because everyone is going to do it differently. And that's actually what makes it wild. And if I were to give a prescription, then it would no longer be wild, because it wouldn't be the will of the individual, the willedness of those individuals and their collective figuring out what willed means and how to get that homeostasis in their particular place. That doesn't mean that we can't understand, you know, or that I can't say certain things. But, you know, like if I were to be like, get more sleep.
Get the basics down.
Go on a walk in nature once a day for 10 minutes. You know, like there's those kinds of things, like, yeah, sure. There's, you know, go do an internet search. There's millions of those things out there. What my focus is on is that central concept of wildness or wildness. And what does that mean on a larger scale throughout human history? And then take that knowledge, understand what the body needs to be willed, what the body needs to be in collaboration with others, because we're not just individuals. We evolved as socially organized organisms. And so we operate communally. We are not individuals.
Yeah.
I mean, we are and we aren't. I'm thinking of, you know, every person has their own amount of willpower, but that can be curbed through the collective will of community and culture, right? You know, kind of understanding the balance of those things is super important. But at the end of the day, what people are going to figure out how to do is beyond me. What I want them to know is what relationship to strive for.
Right. That's the thing. If we give them another, like if we come up with another story to aspire to, what is that going to inspire in each one of us? And I think one of the biggest, you know, besides like the physical aspects, the physiological aspects, of course, you know, what we always talk about, like the mental health aspects of all that, right? Because obviously, because we have been steeped in this kind of culture, in this kind of civilization, it's everything that brings with us and everything, like what I mentioned earlier about just, you know, this immediate return versus delayed return. Like, we think that we are more evolved because we have these executive brains and we can make these like parents decisions, and our toddler brains are all they haven't received the memo. Right. But yeah. No, like, that's just normal. Like, that it's actually because we lived in an environment where that didn't matter. Like, everything was perfect. Actually, we evolved perfectly for a certain kind of environment that no longer exists today. And so right. The problem with that today is everybody, like, people think something's wrong with them, right? People think somehow they're broken, right? Like, I just spent an hour into the Instagram vortex, or just Netflix, another night pissed away at Netflix. But like, it's normal. Like, it's, there's nothing wrong with you, right?
Right, exactly. I do have some pushback just in terms of the use of the word perfect, in the sense that there is actually no such thing as a perfect environment. Evolution is a constant state of trade-offs and changing environments. So there is no such thing as a pure, you know, or perfect environment for humans, but rather there are ones that there are a variety better for us.
Right. There were a variety of environments. Of course, it was always in flux, right? But what I mean is that we, I think, had the resilience to like all those fluctuations in the environment we were adapted for. Except that the fluctuations we have today, we are absolutely not adapted for. It's way too fast, way too much. It's actually the definition of trauma, which is too much, too fast, too soon. And that's exactly what our civilization is constantly piling up on top of us.
Totally. Absolutely.
Yeah. Like you said earlier, like, it takes away all those things that are supposed to be basic needs and then selling them back to us as these luxury things, right?
Yeah.
And not very good copies either.
And in higher concentrated doses than we would have ever had in a natural, non-industrial environment.
Right. I mean, addiction, for example, is typically something you don't really see in more traditional indigenous societies rampant in our cultures.
Yeah.
And do you want to share anything about, like, before we wrap it up, like, anything about where you are, where you were as a, like, with all this work, and what impact has that had on you in terms of putting yourself out into the world, putting your work out into the world, like, in terms of, like, just, you know, becoming more, learning to manage your own mind more, like, you know, getting some of the mindset tools and.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting. You know, a lifelong struggle with depression, even knowing what I know about human needs, but still having challenges with getting those needs met, you know, in a cultural context. I don't have any advice in that sense for anybody. I can't give it, because for me, it's just a constant struggle. Not necessarily a constant struggle, but that makes it sound like it's I don't want to portray it as a constant struggle. I don't want to create that thought or perceive it that way, because then it'll make it seem like it is. No, it's just a constant inquiry into, you know, this balancing act of how can I encourage more resilience in myself? How can I encourage more resilience in my friends and family and environment and other than humans? And that's just kind of where I'm always at. And so I feel like it's been, it just always changes how I'm feeling in terms of resilience. But I do feel like things are getting better. And it's funny because, you know, things are getting worse globally. But for me, like I said, decentralization is actually going to be pretty awesome. And I think it's one of those things where I'm optimistic. I maintain my optimism, which is ironic, because you tell people that civilization's collapsing and they're like, you're such a pessimist. And you're like, no, I'm an optimist. pessimism would be like, everyone's going to die and it's going to be terrible. That's not what I'm saying at all, right? Who knows how the collapse will take shape? There will definitely be horrible things that go on, but there's horrible things going on right now too.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm going to die someday, just like everybody else. So I'd rather go out with dignity. I'd rather die with dignity in the sixth extinction than pretend that civilization was a benefit to this planet. So for me, you know, going forward, it's all about local. I mean, I'm an urban person. I'm not a hunter-gatherer, even by any standards, right? So how do I, that's one of the reasons why I'm so fascinated by horticultural techniques of rewilding, in the same way that, you know, horticulture people do with their subsistence practices, because they're more sedentary, They sort of have this interesting, tenuous relationship. But I basically think things are just going to go backwards. You know, I think decentralization will occur. People are going to end up farming more, growing their own food. We'll see a rise in health from physical activity improving, you know, as well as local food being grown by people. Just, you know, but there's also a lot of potential for bad things to happen too. I'm not saying that everything is perfect, right? But just that, I mean, if you think about it from a non-human perspective, this is the apocalypse. This is the sixth extinction. Human civilization's encroachment, habitat, the amount of habitat loss, that's the sixth extinction. So as soon as civilization no longer has the capacity to destroy habitat in favor of cities and farmland, those forests start to rebound. So the end of civilization is actually the best thing that could happen to ecosystems. It's not the best thing that can happen to people living in a civilizational context. So get out of that context as fast as you can and become willed again, you know, become figure out ways that you can do that. And you don't have to leave the city to do that. Cities are probably going to be one of the worst places to be during a collapse or decentralized process. And if so, and if you're trapped there like me, economically, whatever, all, socially, all the things, then what can you do in these places? So that's the question that I'm always asking. Again, this is why the reality people, they want me to put on some buckskin clothes and go shoot animals in the forest with bows and arrows. I'm like, no, actually, we just bought a greenhouse. We're growing food for people to plant in their backyards. Like, that's what rewilding looks like in an urban context right now, because we're trying to build in local resilience as much as we can before that big transition.
As just your coach, I'm going to have to point out something. What is the upside of saying you're trapped in there? You are fully choosing to be there.
Yeah, no, same thing. Same thing. I mean, what my social connections here are not something I would sacrifice.
Yeah, so you're choosing to live there because that's what you're, I mean. Yeah.
I'm choosing to be here. Absolutely. Yes. So, you know, for me, that's what, you know, my alter ego's name was Urban Scout. And that was part of the whole thing, was figuring out how to, what does rewilding look like in an urban context for me in particular? And to me, that looks like figuring out how to grow as much fucking food here as possible before,
he looked pretty cool
becomes,
too.
Yeah. Before food starts to become even more scarce, you know, get ahead of the game. It will catch up. But we want to be as far ahead in terms of our built-in adaptability and resilience as possible before any of those bigger changes come. And it doesn't matter if we don't get there, because they'll come regardless. The more civilization collapses, the easier it becomes to rewild, is basically what I'm saying.
So that's a pretty comforting thought, actually.
Yeah. The more of a cultural push there is to rewild, because the chains have been broken that keep us bound in this way of life. And the need for local resilience goes through the roof. So it becomes easier. It's just a matter of waiting, you know, holding on until that point of diminishing returns.
So it's almost like, you know, what you're saying is that we're going through the worst, the hardest part of it already.
I don't know if it's already, but yeah, I mean, for the world, absolutely. For the ecosystems, absolutely, this is the hardest part. That point of the maximum consumption of resources, which are living things. And when that maximum consumption breaks, then it goes the other way and systems rebound, ecosystems rebound. I mean, look at Chernobyl. It's more healthy now without a city there than it was with the city there, ecologically speaking. There's more biodiversity. It's thriving ecologically, even though it's completely radioactive. But there's no people there anymore. Not humans, but civilization is gone, right? There actually are some there, the babushkas.
I love it.
The old ladies, yeah, they didn't care. They're like, we're going back home.
So cool.
They're like, we don't care. We'll die of radiation poisoning. We're old.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I mean, we can go on and on forever, of course.
Yeah.
There's so much. And where can people find you? What are you offering for those of us who don't live on the West Coast of the United States?
Yeah, well, my website, petermichaelbauer.com, has some of my writings and stuff. You could buy my book, Rewild or Die. I'll be offering online courses through rewildportland.com, my Rewilding 101. There's one coming up in March. I'm also now offering a Rewilding Your Health class, and I'm going to add a couple of additional ones that are sort of things to take further after a 101 class. And I offer the 101s pretty regularly. So if it's out of a time zone, like, you know, we'll do an American time zone, an Australian time zone, a UK time zone, and kind of like go through those just to sort of reach different people around the world. So it's more effective that way. And then, of course, the Rewilding Conference, which is, if you go to rewilding.com, that's been an online thing. We just did it, so it won't happen again for another year. And it's mainly geared toward North America, but it actually applies to most places around the world, and we may end up changing the name. We'll see.
Cool.
So yeah, that's my thing.
Lots of opportunities. Yes. Go do it, people.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Hey, come join us in our private Facebook group, Redefining the Good Life, where we continue the conversation about just what it means to have a meaningful life today. See you there.